The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Alex Gers, and I'm the Vice President of Communications and Public Programming for the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. I'm very excited to introduce tonight's author to you. I first encountered Dave Barry as a fifth grader who snuck my dad's copy of Dave Barry Slept Here, a sort of history of the United States, off of his bookshelf. I read it backstage during my school's holiday play as I waited my turn to sing some kind of a carol. I was about 11 years old, and I didn't have a firm grasp on the historical players or events, but I understood enough to know that it was hilarious when Dave wrote, for instance, that during the 1960 presidential debate, Kennedy, who looked tanned and relaxed, seemed to have an advantage over Nixon, who looked as though he had been coached by ferrets. From then on, I anxiously awaited his column every Thursday. Now, some 30 years later, I just as anxiously await his annual year in review in the Washington Post, as well as his long-form works that continue to delight. Called A Genuine Genius by the very smart folks at the New York Times Book Review, Dave Barry won the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 1988. He wrote for the Miami Herald for 30 years, where his column was syndicated in more than 500 newspapers, including mine in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. On top of that are his dozens of best-selling works of fiction and nonfiction and his essay collections. Tonight, we're here to celebrate his latest novel, Swamp Story. Mapping the intersecting fates of a young mother who stumbles upon treasure, a debauched newspaper man, and a wannabe reality star, Swamp Story is a quintessentially Floridian caper. I'm certain that we're going to have a lot of fun tonight, so please join me in welcoming Dave Barry to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Alex. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. Alex and I have a connection, which I'm going to get to in a minute, not just that I'm way older than she is. Anyway, it's nice to be back in Philadelphia. I lived here for many years. I lived in Glen Mills. I worked for the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and some of my good friends are here tonight from the old days, and I went to Haverford College. Our motto is, we never heard of you either. So anyway, I'm on a book tour. I just started last week, and I'll be basically 3 weeks, just every day a different city. And I think it's like paintings, where like if the painter is dead, the painting is worth more. And I think publishers feel the same way about books, and that's why they send you on book tours. That they want to kill you, but. I've been doing book tours for 40 years now. I started the first book was that I wrote that I did anything publishing was like 1983, and the first time I was ever on television for a book, the first show I was on was the Johnny Carson show, and yeah, it was called The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in 1984. And it was bizarre. That's would be the last show you would get on. In my case, it was the first. What happened? I had written this book for Rodale Press, this little tiny book. It was a parody of do-it-yourself books called The Taming of the Screw, and it was just a little nothing book. And I don't know how this woman got hold of it, but a legendary booker for the Tonight Show named Shirley Wood, who'd been in showbiz forever. She's basically a tough old broad, if you're still allowed to say that. I get this phone call at my house here, back here in Glen Mills, Pennsylvania, and it was this, Shirley Wood. She smoked a lot. And she told me who she was, and she said, I read your book. Your book is funny. Are you funny? You know, and she asked me a bunch of questions, and I answered them. She apparently liked the answer, so she set it up that I would. And all this is completely new to me. I've never been on television before. And they fly me to L.A. A limo picks me up at the airport, takes me directly to the studio. And then I get taken backstage, and there's like dressing room doors, and it was the Pointer Sisters with a star, Dick Cavett with a star, Dave Barry with a star, and that was my dressing room. And like, I didn't have anything to dress in. I was wearing the clothes that I wore on the plane, you know. And next door I can hear, you know, the Pointer Sisters have like their entourage and it's always going on. But anyway, so about a half an hour before I'm supposed to go on, Shirley Wood shows up in my dressing room, in my little green room where I've just been sitting alone listening to noise. And she gives me a tumbler of wine, white wine, just not a wine glass, like a glass, a water glass, and says, "Drink this." And she goes, "Remember what you said?" And she has typed out the answers I had given her on the phone. And I go, "Yeah." And she goes, "Just say that. Just say that." And so anyway, and then next thing I know, I'm standing in front of that famous multicolored curtain. And then the curtain opens. And here's, you know, I go out and I'm on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And it just went great. He was so perfect. You know, he just, every question he asked perfectly, listened to the answer. His reactions, you know, like he let the audience know this is funny, you know, and it was just easy. It was just felt so easy to me, the whole thing. And the thing I remember, the only actual conversation I had with him was he kept me over for a commercial break, which I later found out was a big deal, that, you know, he didn't just have the one little segment, he had two segments. And in the commercial break, and my book was about doing it yourself, but it was a parody of do it yourself books. And as soon as the camera light goes off, he lights a cigarette, first thing he does. And then he turns to me and he goes, "I used to do it yourself. You can't do shit yourself." And that was my conversation with But anyway, it went great, you know. And then I got off and they immediately got on a limo, back in a limo, and went right straight back to LAX and flew home on a red eye. You know, that was it. That was my, you know, Hollywood experience. But then I got home and everybody had seen it and everybody thought it was great. And I thought, Jesus, TV, it's easy. It's like great. That turned out to be the best TV interview I ever had. It never was ever going to be that good again. He was the best interviewer I ever had. That's why he was Johnny Carson. And so over the years after that, I would go on book tour after book tour after book tour and be interviewed by many, many people. And a lot of them had not read my book. And some of them had not read any book. And, you know, do you know David McCullough? It was the great David McCullough. He's a wonderful writer, the late David McCullough. And I got to know him at a book conference in Sun Valley, Idaho. And we were having dinner, and we were talking about just this, about, like, the experience of going on book tour and being interviewed by people who are not familiar with your book and not always necessarily sentient human beings, you know. And we were trading stories about, like, bad experiences we've had on book tours. And he told me one, he was on a TV show with a guy, as he described him, like a Ken doll kind of guy, who was just reading the questions that his producer had given him. And David was promoting a book called The Path Between the Seas, a great, terrific book about the building of the Panama Canal. And it was 1978, and the Ken doll, the interviewer, asked him, he said, how do you feel about the United States turning the Panama Canal over to the Republic of Panama, which was the big issue then? And David answered, in a sense, the Panama Canal will always be American, in the same sense that Normandy Beach will always be American. And he said the guy looked really kind of confused and then said, "Who is Normandy Beach?" So he had me beat there. But that is a much more typical of the book tour experience. But you will do anything on a book tour. You reach a point where you just do anything you are asked to do to promote your book. Back in the 90s, I was on a book tour, and I was in St. Louis. And I got a call from my publicist saying the Oprah is interested, they're having you on your show. And I'd been on the Oprah show a couple times, never as the main guest, but as a panelist. You know, she would get different people on to talk about whatever the issue of the day was. And but you always want to go on the Oprah show. She moves a lot of books, Oprah does, and so everybody knows it. So he said, you know, the producer wants to talk to you. So I call the producer. The producer says, okay, we're doing a show about, like, righting wrongs, where people are going to confess to things they have done wrong and make it right on the air. You know, and we're doing this show tomorrow in Chicago. You know, would you like to be on that panel? And I go, yeah, because, you know, it's Oprah. And she goes, so, like, what would you confess to that you've done on the air? And so I thought about it, and I came up with something, which is, a few years earlier, I had been in a Hyatt hotel, and there was a sign in the bathroom, a little plastic fold, you know, a tent sign that said, our guest towels are 100% cotton. If you would like to purchase the set, they're available for $75. Should you prefer to take the set already in your room, that will be added to your bill. So it's basically they're saying, if you steal these towels, we're going to charge you $75. So I stole the sign. So I thought it was a funny sign, and I for years had it in the guest bathroom, and so I told the Oprah producer that, and she says, oh, that's perfect. Yeah, so you'll bring the sign in and confess to that on the air, and we're going to have a box, and you'll drop the sign in the box. The problem was, and I said, okay, great, and I'm going to be on the Oprah show. The problem was the sign was in Miami, and I was in St. Louis, and the show was the next day in Chicago. There's no way to get the sign to Chicago in time. But then it occurred to me that I was staying in a Hyatt hotel in St. Louis. This is all true. So I stole another sign. This was like not a towel sign. It was like no smoking or something. But I took it, and then when I got on the show, I told that story, and I dropped it in the box. And so in other words, I lied again and stole a second sign. That's the kind of whore you become when you are out promoting a book. The worst thing that happens on book tour, and it has happened to every author I know, even some really, really good authors, is when you do a signing. The worst is like usual mall bookstores, although there are fewer and fewer of those, but where like they set it up, they put a table with a pile of books and you're like a sign that says, meet the author, your picture in the pile of books, you know, and then you sit there at a table and nobody comes. That is the worst, the lowest of the low when you're really tired already. And the bookstore people trying to make excuses. Like I say, so it's always dead, just like before Christmas, like this, you know. And you just sit there, and you there's like this like 2 hours you're supposed to sit there, and you're just sitting there. People will come up, the mall dwellers come up, and you know, look at the books, look at the sign which says your picture on it, says meet the author, and look at you, and then look at the books, look at the sign, and look at you, and go, did you write this book? You know, and then and then they walk away. And then, but then every now and then, there's that magical moment when somebody will just, without even seeing the same look, seeing, wait a minute, are you Dave Barry? And go, yeah. And go, do you know where the men's room is? You know. So the lowest of the low, though, of all the book tour experiences, is, and this has happened to me, I don't know, a dozen or so times in the course of my book touring. Is when they have a local TV station that wants to do a feature on what it's like to be an author on tour, and they assign a camera crew, you know, a camera person and a sound guy usually, to come and follow you around for the day. And they always say the same thing, which is, we'll just be out of your way, just do whatever you would ordinarily do. And then, of course, when it actually happens, they'll always go, could you come through the door again, because we missed that, you know. So I did that in Seattle once, and it was like just really an exhausting part of my tour. And I'd been, at, you know, day after day after day, late nights, early mornings, day and flights early. And they met me at the airport, followed me around all day, and a lot of events that day, a lot of media. And then there was this like 45-minute break between the last thing and then the book signing that night, where I was going to be able to go to the hotel room and just relax for just 45 minutes without these guys always right next to me. Nice guys, but they're just always there, and you just can't relax. And so finally we get to the hotel in Seattle, and I go up to my room, and what the publicist had forgotten to tell me about this next part And I open the door to my room, and there's another TV crew standing in the room. Like, and this was three people. It was a cameraman, a sound person, a woman, a reporter. And I open the door, and I go, you know, what? And they go, oh, didn't they tell you that we were going to do a little event, you know, a little thing on you coming into your hotel room? And I go, but, well, like, what if I had to go to the bathroom? And she goes, do you? So anyway, that was, well, anyway, okay, enough of that. But that's where I'm coming from. I'm on a book tour. But I'm happy that you're here because, you know, means I can have a reason to be here. So thank you for coming out. I'm going to talk about my new novel. It's called Swamp Story. And it's sort of, the swamp in question is the Everglades, which is right next to where I live. I live in Miami, moved there in 1986 from the United States. And and I am a... I've lived in Miami long enough to really love Miami. It's like my home. My wife is from there. She's Cuban Jewish, actually. Juban, they call themselves. Now there's a lot of Jubans in Miami. They didn't come on rafts. They parted the Caribbean. People have an unfortunate image of the city of Miami. People have never been there. You know, we're viewed as kind of an insane, crazy, wild city. Some people think we have like a lot of crime. There's, you know, kind of a holdover from the Miami Vice era. And a lot of people think it's a dangerous and violent place. And that hurts those of us who live here. We want to track those people down and kill them because it's really a lovely place now. It's changed quite a bit. And we have a new attitude, new tourism promotion slogan. Come back to Miami. We weren't shooting at you. Miami does have... I mean, strange things happen in Miami. I will not deny that. Alex, who introduced me, reminded me of one of them because she was indirectly related to it. When I first moved to Miami, I wrote a column about this incident. It was in the Herald one day, and I thought that I can't believe that. And I went down and interviewed the folks involved. But what happened was a guy named Kurt Ivey, who was the chief of police of Homestead, which is a city south of Miami, was holding a citizens' crime. He was speaking at a citizens' crime watch meeting. There was a neighborhood down there that just started a citizens' crime watch, and they wanted the chief of police to come explain how it worked. And so Kurt, as chief of police, went down to give him a little explanation. And it was a nice night, so they were holding the meeting outdoors on somebody's patio in this nice little neighborhood. So anyway, it's all going well. Chief of Police Kurt Ivey is talking to the Citizens Crime Watch group, and he is almost hit on the head by a 75-pound bale of cocaine falling from the sky. That really happened. It was a smuggler's plane coming over from the Bahamas, and a U.S. Customs Service jet was forcing them down. This is when there was a lot of cocaine coming into Miami in the 80s. So the Customs Service jet is trying to force these guys down, and they're flinging these bales of cocaine out as fast as they can. And they finally were forced down in Naples on the other side of the state. And they flung a whole bunch out on the way, which set off a treasure hunt in the Everglades. But the point is, the chief of police was almost killed by falling cocaine, which if you were to write that in a screenplay, everybody would just say, that's stupid. That would never happen. But the reason I bring it up, Alex told me while we were backstage that her father sold that plane, which is a connection I never thought I was going to make with anybody. Another Miami story while I'm on things that I don't think would happen anywhere else. This was maybe 10 years after that. I'm living in Miami, and I get a call from this woman I know who works for the Miami Herald. And she says, I think you need to know this. I'm on the People Mover. Now, the People Mover is this little thing that goes, a little train, little automated tram that goes around in a big circle in downtown Miami. She goes, I'm on the People Mover. This is rush hour. I'm on the People Mover, and there's a shark on the People Mover. And it's not dead. So what happened was, this became a big story in the Miami Herald. What happened was these two homeless guys were fishing in Biscayne Bay and caught a nurse shark, a 6-foot-long nurse shark, and they figured it might have some value. And there are these seafood restaurants on the Miami River. And for I don't know why these guys thought that the seafood restaurants might be willing to buy a nurse shark. I really don't know why they thought that, but they did. But they didn't have any way to get there. They didn't have a car, so they decided to take the people mover, which is not designed for marine life. I mean, that's why it's called the people mover. But they're on it, and the shark was not dead, and it's like not really that funny, I guess. Well, yes, it is, let's be honest, but we're going to pretend it's not funny. And the shark is gasping on the people mover, and they get over there, and nobody, of course, wants to buy their shark, so they end up leaving it on the streets of Miami, where it became a story in the Miami Herald the next day. Like, the, you know, people came to work, and there's a shark on the street, and they called the police, you know. And my favorite quote was from a shopkeeper in downtown Miami, who said when he first got there, he was really upset because he thought it was a dead body, and he was so pleased to see it was just a shark. Which that's it's a feel-good story then, you know, Miami style. So Miami is a weird place. That is part of the reason why I like to write Miami stories. I'll get the other later. But it's not just Miami that has this sort of reputation. The whole state of Florida has gradually become a big, like, sort of laughing stock for the rest of the country. It started with the 2000 presidential election. I don't know if you remember that. We remember it vividly down in Miami. But that was the election between Bush and Gore, where all the other states were able to figure out, using arithmetic, whom they had voted for. But Florida was unable to make that determination. And it turned out that it mattered. Whoever won Florida was going to win the presidency. It was between Bush and Gore. And so I don't remember that night, long, long night. First they call it for Bush, then they call it for Gore. Then they call it for Bush again. And I think briefly William Shatner was in the lead. And then comes dawn and they don't know. They just don't know. So for the next 2 or 3 weeks, this is the only story in the country. Everybody is looking at Florida and thinking, why can't you figure out who you voted for? And they had, you know, the Palm Beach elections officials holding up these ballots that looked like they've been attacked by weasels, you know. Trying to figure out what that meant, and it was just awful because Florida voters were unable to punch a hole correctly in a piece of cardboard. I proposed a simple Florida-proof ballot at the time, which was that you would just print photographs of the candidates' faces, and you would vote by poking out your candidate's eyeball, you know, but they didn't go for that. So anyway, after that, Florida gradually became more and more of a joke, and now we are like the focus of a lot of jokes. Everybody makes fun of us. Everybody's mocking us. There's all this whole Florida man meme, and I say this as a person who spends a lot of time traveling around the country. People think we are all idiots in Florida, which bothers me. I mean, is it fair to judge, and we are 21 million people, is it fair to judge 21 million people because of the behavior of 19 million people? And it's not really all our fault. And I will explain what I said in the form of an anecdote. And this is a true story. You may actually remember this story because it was international news when it happened. This is maybe 10 years ago, but it was a pretty big story when it happened. It was a police report. A woman was driving south on the overseas highway that connects the mainland to Key West. She was going to Key West. And according to the Florida State Highway Patrol report written about this incident, she was in a hurry to get to Key West because she wanted to see her boyfriend who lived down there. So, and she also wanted to look good for him. So she decided to shave her bikini region. Now, some people would pull over to the side of the road. But as I say, she was in a hurry. So she decided to outsource the steering of the car to the passenger who was, and this is one of the things that made this story so well known, her ex-husband. This is all true, according to the Florida State Highway Patrol report. So they're going south at about 40 miles an hour. She is operating the accelerator but not looking at the road because she's shaving herself, and her ex-husband is steering the car. Okay, what could possibly go wrong? So as it happens, the car in front of them slowed down to make a turn and they slammed into it and there was an accident and that became the story. And this was written up in great detail by a Florida State Highway Patrol person and it became international news. I mean, it was in the Miami Herald, but then it was everywhere. It was in every FM morning show. It was the late night talk shows. And it reflected poorly on the state of Florida. It was like, everybody, can you believe these morons in Florida, these idiots? This woman, like, what is wrong with these people in Florida, 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 Florida? That woman was from Indiana. She was shaving her Hoosier. You always wondered what that expression. But we got the blame. And so that's why I say we are sort of like we're the Ellis Island for weird, stupid people. That when they want to do something really ridiculous, they come down and do it in Florida. And we get the blame for it. So anyway, the point is my state, my city are really good sources of humor. It's like if you want to be a humor columnist, it's a good place to live. But also if you want to write a novel, it's a good place to live. I have a really good friend, Carl Hyacin, is a great writer, does wonderful story, novels about South Florida. And he always says, you don't need an imagination to write novels about Florida. You just need a subscription to the newspaper. Because nothing that you could make up would be weirder than the things that are actually going on. The first novel I wrote about Florida was called Big Trouble. And one of the central elements of that novel was that there was a bar in South Florida, in Miami, where Russians were selling nuclear weapons left over from the Soviet Union, smuggled out of the Soviet Union. And everybody asked me, where did you get that idea? And I said, I got it from a story in the Miami Herald about a bar where Russians were selling nuclear weapons. And in the case of my book, Swamp Story, there really isn't anything in it that I don't think actually could happen in South Florida, or has, in some cases, already has happened in South Florida, which makes it a lot easier. But what I did when I wrote this book, which sort of bring, the idea was sort of, there's Miami, I don't know if you've ever been down there, but the Everglades sort of occupy the middle of the state, down in the southern part of the state, really almost to the edges. The people live just on the edges. Miami is just this little sliver along the Atlantic coast. And the rest, the middle of the state is all this just what looks like undifferentiated swamp. But it's really not. When you first get there, you drive across and you just think there's nothing but sawgrass and alligators and snakes. But really, it's not. There's a lot of stuff going on in there, as I've learned over the years. And so what I tried to do was bring out some of the stuff that happens in the middle of the state and the way it interacts with the edge of the state where I live. So there are a couple of elements that I wanted to include in the book that sometimes people don't believe are real, but they are real. The first one, and one of the things that very early on I knew I wanted to write a book about this, that included in a book the first time it happened. It's called the Python Challenge. I don't know if anybody here has ever heard of that, but it's a big deal in Florida, and it's a real thing. We have a problem with pythons, Burmese pythons in South Florida. And these are large constrictor snakes. They get to be 15 feet long sometimes. They're very big snakes. And they eat everything. They have no natural enemies down there. And they are an invasive species. They're not supposed to be in South Florida. They're supposed to be in Burma. That's why we call them that, wherever the hell Burma is. No, I think it's called Myanmar now. But anyway, they don't know that. They're in Florida. What happened was they were originally pets. People like exotic pets in South Florida to a ridiculous degree. So these people had these Burmese pythons as pets, and then they ran out of crack. And they went, oh, shit, we're living with a Burmese python. Whoa. So they let them go. They just let them go. And they were happy to be gone. They thrive in South. They're like New Yorkers. They love it down there. And they multiply like crazy. And there are every mama Burmese python lays 100 eggs a year. So the estimates are they're in the hundreds of thousands now of these things out there in the Everglades and sometimes coming into the more urban areas. I cannot stress how big these snakes are. They're very, very big snakes. So the state of Florida And this is one of the most wonderful ideas that we've ever had, I think, as a state. Came up with this idea of the Python Challenge, which is a contest where the state invites people, anybody who wants to come down a certain time of year and kill our snakes, kill our pythons. And there's a cash prize for the biggest, longest python, cash prize for the most pythons. And this attracts the kind of people who view that as an attractive thing to do, you know. But it's a state-run thing, so it's the Florida State Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. So it's very kind of bureaucratic in the way they run it. And I urge you, if you're really just bored someday, to go on the internet and look up the rules for the Python Challenge, because it's regulated. First of all, you can't just go out there. You have to pay an entrance fee and fill out an application. And most important of all, for safety, take a short online course. And ask anybody who's ever dealt with dangerous animals in the wild, what's the way to learn how to do that? A short online course. Everyone agrees on that. So, and it's one of the things it talks about on how you kill the python. The state is very concerned about the right and wrong way to kill the python. Now, I would have guessed you just chop off the head, but no. That is not, you're not allowed to do it that way because it's inhumane. Because if you just cut off the head, the brain apparently keeps thinking, according to the Florida State. It doesn't say what it's thinking. Like, holy shit, you know, what? So you have to kill it a certain way where you drive a thing through its brain to stop the brain from thinking. Anyway, so I really wanted to include that. What's wonderful about the Python Challenge in my mind is, and I've been following it over the years, every year they announce the Python Challenge as the big opening ceremony, and then and at the end of the thing they announce the winners and they show the winners with their snakes and everything. Every year they kill between 200 and 300 snakes. So do the math. There's hundreds of thousands of them out there. Every female is laying 100 eggs. So they're winning. The pythons are winning the Python Challenge. They're killing us. We should have challenged an animal we could beat. The manatees, we could beat them, you know. No, that's a joke. I defend the manatees. In fact, I came up with an idea for protecting the manatees. Nobody took me up on it, but so we have a problem. The problem is the boaters in Florida drive like the drivers in Florida, which is not well at all, and they go way too fast, and they hit the manatees. And there have been all these efforts to slow the boaters down, and they really have not been effective because the boat drivers are insane down there. So I came up with an idea, proposed this a while ago. If we can't slow the boaters down, let's speed the manatees up. I said, let's take some federal money and put motors on the manatees. And when the first time a boater is killed by a manatee going 70, 80 miles an hour, they might learn to slow down. But anyway, so anyway, the Python Challenge plays an important role in Swamp Story. It comes up later in the book. When I started to write this book, I was always thinking, I need to get to a scene with the Python Challenge in it, and that's what I was working for the whole thing. Another big element in the book, I got this idea from a book I wrote a few years ago. It was called Best State Ever. It was a defense of the state of Florida. And what I did for that book, it was not a fiction book, it was essays. I went around the state and I went to tourist attractions, not the big ones, not Disney, but the sketchy roadside attractions that there used to be so many of in Florida and are fewer and fewer of every year just because everybody now goes to Disney instead, although our governor's going to shut them down, don't worry. And anyway, when I did that book, the Best State Ever, one of my favorite places I went to, it was on the Tamiami Trail, which is Route 41, connects Miami and Tampa. It's the old road across the state. Now everybody takes I-75, but you can still go across on Route 41, which is more old Everglades. And in the middle of the state, right out in the middle of the Everglades, is a place called the Skunk Ape Research Headquarters, which is this shack with this gorilla-like thing out front. And the skunk ape is this creature that allegedly lives out in the Everglades. And it's like Bigfoot. That is to say, it's probably not real. Or like the guy you're waiting for on hold in customer service. You know, not really there, but people believe in it. And there's a guy out there named Dave Shealy who operates the Skunk Ape Research, who claims to have seen the skunk ape long ago. And he's what they call a gladesman. He's lived in the Everglades his whole life. His parents were from the Everglades. He just lives out there. And there's sort of a dwindling crew of people out there, Everglades people. But I just love the idea of this weird little, you know, he just basically selling T-shirts. And every now and then somebody will stop and Dave Shealy will tell him about the time he saw the skunk ape. And every now and then people go out looking for it. And some people claim to have seen it, you know. But when I did that story, did that essay, Dave Shealy drove me around, and I all these back roads in the Everglades and dead ends and like kind of deserted little towns, and there's a lot of stuff back there. People who live back there that don't want you to know they're back there, and there are nefarious things going on back there. There's a lot going on in the Everglades that nobody knows about because that's why they're there. That's why they're in the Everglades. And there are these glades people who just always lived there. And then there's the Miccosukee Indian tribe that's out there that have their own legends about what's... There's a lot of stuff in the Everglades, and I kind of wanted to bring that out in this story. So in the book, and I don't want to get too far into the plot, but there are these guys who I made up that are kind of like jealous of the Skunk Ape Research Headquarters. That's like they aspire to that because they're an even worse tourist attraction than that. And they come up with their own idea. One of them does anyway for creating their own monster, and they're terribly incompetent human beings, but they want to make a video of this thing, and they decide to call it the Everglades Melon Monster, and they want to go out and create this video. And get people to come to their store and buy their T-shirts. That's really the idea behind them. And they're, as I say, they're not very bright, but they talk this guy I call Phil, who is basically the me in this book, who's an ex-newspaper guy, and he's an alcoholic, I don't think I am yet, but he's like represents my point of view, and he's sort of desperate. He's been fired because he's a drunk on the job, and he needs money because his daughter, who is estranged, his wife is estranged, is divorced him, but his daughter wants to go on a class trip, and she has no money, and Phil feels like just a jerk because he can't. And anyway, he agrees to be the Everglades Melon Monster, which requires him to put on a Dora the Explorer costume head. It's like a football-like thing. And so that's the plan. And it's so stupid that it should never in a million years work, but it does because of TikTok. Now, you're all old people, so you may not know what TikTok is. TikTok is an app invented by the Chinese to keep the United States from ever doing anything productive again. They're over there making things, and we're over here going, look at that dog. Oh, my God. Oh, look. She's making ravioli with a tennis racket. Oh, look at that cat. Where'd they get all that mayonnaise? Oh, look at that dog. Look at these people. It's just like that. And then, like, you know, you keep just scrolling through it and scrolling through it. Next thing you know, the sun is going down. And you're still in your pajamas, you know. And over there in China, they made 8 million computers during that time. So TikTok, though, it has the ability, and I got into this because of my daughter, who's 23 years old, and I want to stress is a perfectly intelligent, educated human being, but she is aware of TikTok because everybody that age is, and she'll show me these things on there, and I'll say, wow, what is it? She'll say, 13 million people looked at that, you know. In other words, you can, with your phone, do something ridiculous, and suddenly it becomes a worldwide phenomenon. It just sort of depends. Nobody ever really knows how it's going to happen, when it's going to happen. These guys make their stupid video, and it becomes, through random chance, which I discuss in the book, becomes a worldwide phenomenon. And suddenly, they're much more successful than they had any right to be. So anyway, I'm going to read you a little bit from the book, having set that all up. The guys who are doing this TikTok stuff are, for the most part, complete morons. And they smoke a lot of weed. So in addition to being morons, they're impaired morons. And much of the book describes their efforts to do various, carry. So they've made one video, and now they want to make another video because the first one was so successful. And this is their gathering. They have gathered together to prepare to make the second video. And it's a bunch of guys, one of whom is Phil, which is the guy representing my point of view, in that he's an older guy who thinks everybody else is stupid. And I based this little scene that I wrote on, I went out with my wife, drove out through the Everglades various times just to sort of scout locations to write the novel. And one of the times out there, driving along the middle of the day, and we go by this tree, and there's this gigantic owl, like, you know, Shaquille O'Neal owl, just sitting there on this tree, like big owl. I didn't realize owls were that big. I thought they were kind of cute little thing. Anyway, I later found out it's a barred owl, B-A-R-R-E-D, and they're common in the Everglades, although you don't see them all that often. They're out there. Anyway, that inspired this scene. So these guys have just now sat down, getting ready. They're getting ready, pre-gaming, to go out and make their video for their second attempt to make an Everglades Melon Monster video to follow up on the first smash hit one that has taken the world by storm. And this happens. "Look," said Kark, pointing toward a tree at the edge of the clearing. The others looked. Sitting on one of the lower tree branches, looking back at them, was a large owl. "That's a barred owl," said Ken. "They live out here." "In the daytime?" said Slater. "Yes, in the daytime," said Ken. "Also the nighttime. What, do you think they commute?" "No, asshole," said Slater. Slater and Ken hate each other. "No, asshole," said Slater. "I meant owls come out at night." "Maybe you should tell that one," said Ken. "You're thinking of bats," said Stu. "They fly around at night by radar." "Owls fly at night too," said Slater. "That's an expression, night owl." Ken rolled his eyes. Phil, that's me, looking at Stu, said, "Did you say bats fly by radar?" "Yeah," said Stu. "I saw a documentary. They use radar to catch bugs." "I saw that too," said Slater, nodding. "Animal Planet." "It's sonar," said Phil. "What is?" said Stu. "Bats use sonar," said Phil, "not radar." "I think you're thinking of submarines," said Stu. "I am not thinking of submarines," said Phil. "Submarines use sonar," said Stu. "He's right," said Slater. "No, he is not right," said Phil. "You're saying submarines don't use sonar?" said Slater. "No," said Phil. "I mean, yes, submarines use sonar." "Well, that's what he said," said Slater. "I know that's what he said," said Phil. "You don't have to shout," said Slater. Phil took a deep breath, exhaled. "Okay," he said. "The point is, yes, submarines use sonar, but bats also use sonar. Bats do not use radar. Airplanes use radar." "According to you," said Slater. "No," said Phil, "according to science." "You're telling me Animal Planet isn't science?" said Slater. "Jesus H. Christ," said Phil. "Okay," said Stu, speaking unnaturally slowly. "Hear me out, Phil. Airplanes fly, right?" "Yes," said Phil. "And bats also fly, right?" "Right," said Phil. But submarines do not fly, right?" "Right, but what?" "I rest my case," said Stu. "He has you there," says Slater. "He doesn't have shit," said Phil. "Dude, you need to calm down," said Slater, handing Phil a third joint. "It's just a discussion." "Yeah," said Phil, taking the joint, "but it's a stupid discussion." "Maybe so, dude," said Slater, "but you're like half of it." So anyway, those are the brains behind the operation that. Anyway, there's also a love story in the book, but I'm not going to get into that because it's, you know, when you just say it's a love story and a bunch of other stuff. But anyway, that gives you the sort of an idea. Basically, it's a story based on a bunch of things that I think actually could happen, but only could happen in South Florida. So I would be happy to take any questions anybody has, or if anybody has any problems at home you want to share with the group. Yes, sir.
Over the time you've been writing, tech has changed a lot. Have you encountered that and dealt with changing tech?
How have I encountered and dealt with changing tech? Well, I every 3 to 4 months need to buy a new computer because I just need one because it has more gigs. I'd say, I think you're asking a more philosophical, I mean, The big change that affects not so much my life, but the world that I've been in most of my life is the way tech has changed the newspaper industry. I'm the newspaper guy, always have been. All my friends are newspaper people. And it has basically destroyed the newspaper industry. I mean, it's sad to say, but the business model of newspapers has been utterly destroyed. This is a simple and depressing version, but we used to believe that the reason that people wanted to read the stories that we wrote was because they were really interested in the news of the Middle East and of their local government and so on and so on. And then we now realize they didn't particularly care about that. They just were getting the newspaper cheap, and there was no other way to get, you know, a lot of stuff. And the reason people advertised in the newspaper was no other way to reach the readers. And now all that has changed, and we're discovering that there are a lot of people who are just dying to read about the Middle East. And I should have known that. When I worked at the Daily Local News, I will say this, back in the 70s, it's a good education in what readers care about. We could have put on the front page of the newspaper that there was a nuclear missile headed toward Westchester, Pennsylvania, and I don't think we would have heard much about it. But if we were to leave Virgo out of the horoscope, the phone would ring off the hook, you know, so like that should have been a hint to me. And I wrote all these stories about like the Downingtown Area Regional Sewage Commission that I realize now nobody read, you know. I didn't probably even read to the end of them, and I wrote them. So that's a depressing answer. But the big change for me has been that, you know, the tech. And, you know, and I guess the next thing is everybody's talking about AI, and you know, that's going to change the world, and it's going to, I don't know. And that's happening so fast, I can't really tell. I will say this, when the ChatGPT first came out, which is feels like 10 years ago, but was basically 3 months ago, something like not even, many people sent me the same email. And the email was, I asked ChatGPT to write a column in the style of Dave Barry, and here's what it did, you know. And I read them all, and they sucked. So my feeling was, at that time, I don't care if it destroys humanity. It's not taking my job away, you know. But they keep telling me it's going to get better. And, you know, so, you know, I don't know. That's a terrible answer, but that's my answer. Yeah.
One of your most memorable columns, I recall, was you asked readers to submit their stories around Florida of really bad Florida drivers. And a few stick out in my mind. There was one where there was someone shaving their head through a sunroof along I-95. There was another you witnessed where it was somebody watching the TV GPS screen. So I wondered if you had any more stories in that vein you could share with us.
Yeah, okay.
Updates.
Miami driving, I contend, I mean, I've driven all over the world, and I don't think there's anybody can compare with Miami driving. And my joke is, it's not that they don't know the law. They're all driving according to the law of his or her individual country of origin, you know, and well, okay, I'll just one. This is maybe 10 years ago. The Miami police stopped a 72-year-old man driving a Chevrolet Cobalt, which is not that weird until you know that they stopped him on runway 9 of Miami International Airport. Without really burst through a perimeter gate and was out there on the runway. And to me, that shows a lack of awareness. I don't know about you. If I'm driving, I realize I'm tailgating a 757. I think, whoa. I'm not on the expressway anymore here. But, I mean, every single day I see people, I mean, the idea of somebody just backing up on I-95 to reach, that is so normal in Miami. Okay, there's a guy backing up, you know, in a lane. Most of us are going that way. He's going backwards, but he's got his backup lights on, so sort of an indication to the rest of us. They're crazy. Yeah. Tinkerbell, ladies, stand up and show people why I'm saying that. See, show them your star so that they can call the police. This woman, I have to say, a few, 15, 20 years ago, I wrote a series of books with Ridley Pearson about called Peter and the Starcatchers, about a prequels to Peter Pan. And this woman, right? It was you. It was a event in New York City at the Barnes & Noble at Columbus Circle or something like that. In she comes. You were dressed completely.
Oh, I had the whole costume.
Yeah. She did. And very, very embarrassed children, as I recall.
Yep.
They said you took the subway and that they just didn't even want to be in the same car with you. Anyway, did you have a question, or are you just showing off your star?
Well, I'm just saying hello, but I'm going to ask you if any of your books were banned. If not, would you like them to be?
Yeah. Well, I certainly wouldn't want any of my books to be available to children in the schools. So I hope they're banning them. If they're not, I would advocate that.
Hi, Dave. Absolutely love your work.
And thank you.
And my mom, you were a favorite of my mom's when she was a...
She's a good lady.
She was alive. Yeah. What I wanted to know is, when did you first realize you had this, amazing gift for humor, and how did you coach it along with yourself or somebody else, to get it to basically on your way to the obvious stardom that you have experienced?
Well, the key is I have no useful skills. This is my main skill. But I can, I've been asked often, where did my sense of humor come from? And I know exactly where it came from. I mean, it's my mother's sense of humor. I had a very edgy mom. I'm 75, so I grew up in the 50s, basically, in a little town called Armonk, New York. So my mom, there were four of us, and my mom was a housewife, which is what most of the moms did back then. And she was just different from the other moms, but it wasn't obvious to us because that was our mom. She was like very edgy and just didn't take anything seriously. That was the worst thing you could do in our family, was take something seriously, especially yourself. So, like, just early memory, we had a pond behind our house, and my sister Kate and I used to go out and play around the pond, and now you would be arrested, I guess, if you let the pond safety committee would be. But we just go to the pond. We go out to the pond, and my mom would roll up, open the kitchen window and go, "Don't drown, kids!" And we go, "We won't." We thought that was hilarious to joke about that. Or she used to take us to run errands in Armonk, downtown Armonk. You go to the Bracetti's Market, you go to the Louis the Cleaner or whatever, and she would just take us around with her. I mean, I remember walking into Bracetti's, and Ray Bracetti is slicing bologna, and he goes, "How you doing, Marion?" They all called her Marion. He goes, "Just shitty, Ray." And she used to say stuff like, just to cheer us up. She's, "Don't worry, someday we'll all be dead." which leads me to, now that you know a little about my mom, just to show you how she was not really, she really didn't take anything too seriously. The day we buried my father, we went to the cemetery, Middle Patent Cemetery, and it was a rainy day, and we had my dad, his ashes in a box, and they had dug a little hole for us. It was my sister and my two brothers and me, and my mom. And we go to just us, and it's rainy, it's a sad day, gray day. And we gather around the hole and put dad's ashes in and put some dirt in, and everybody says something. We're all crying. And then we're walking away from the grave, and I've got my arm around my mom, and it's raining. She starts to look down at some of the grave markers and goes, "So that's why we don't see him around anymore." She just would not ever take anything too seriously. So that really is where it came from. But the rest of it's like, that's all I ever wanted to do. I wanted to, I wanted to be funny. I wanted to amuse people. And it was really just sort of, a question of always pointing in that direction. And eventually, I started writing humor. It took a while, but people started responding to it. And that's how I got here. But there was no, I never said, "I want to be a humor writer. I want to be a humorist. That's what I want to do." It's sort of, that was the only thing I ever could think of doing, more like that than like that this was a career goal, and it just worked out really well. This woman tried before, and this better be good, though, right?
I'm also an alum of the Daily Local News.
You worked at the Daily Local?
Not when you did, but I was in the copy desk, yeah.
Okay, I didn't even know we had a copy desk.
They hired me to...
When was that?
I'm just 2005.
Okay.
And I used to work with someone who worked with you, actually.
Who?
Dave Muller was his name. He was...
Never heard of him.
I know. That wasn't why I got the mic.
Is everybody really bored with this conversation? We could take this outside and discuss it later.
I had a question, but now I have another question. When you read that excerpt First of all, I love that you chose that excerpt. It was so unlikely for a reading, but you write great dialogue.
But because what?
It's so unlikely for a reading to what you did, but you write wonderful dialogue, and I wonder if you've ever tried writing a stage play or even a scene.
Not a stage play. I've written screenplays, a couple of them. I wrote a book with a guy named Alan Zweibel, who is one of the original Saturday Night Live writers, a good friend, great guy. And he and I wrote a book called Lunatics. And we wrote a screenplay for it and sold it to Hollywood. And they didn't make it, of course, because they never do. And then, you know, that I forgot all about it. And then recently Alan sold it again. So we wrote another screenplay, you know. Anyway, and that's all, that's mostly what you're doing is writing dialogue. And I really enjoy it. But in this case, it was like, I like the writing that kind of dialogue because I know every single person involved is an idiot. And it's easier when they're stupid. They don't have to say anything intelligent, you know. So neither do I.
So when you were at Haverford, were you writing like you were now? Or, I mean, like, how did you probably had to take English for,
I was an English major.
You were an English major. So how did your professors like your style of writing, shall we say?
Well, I didn't try to write funny for the professors at Haverford. I did some in high school, but not at college. I was too intimidated by the professors. But I wrote for the Haverford College News, and I wrote a bunch of humor columns for the Haverford College News. And maybe, I don't know, I can't remember. I was a class of 1969. One of our reunions, I think it was the 25th reunion, which would have been like 96, something like that. I went back. And somebody had the idea, because, you know, I was Dave Barry, to take all of my columns that they could find from the Haverford News and blow them up and put them all around the gym. So there were all these columns all around the gym, and I went around reading them, and I didn't get any of the jokes. I still don't know why they were supposed to be funny at the time, and I suspect that possibly the drugs had something to do with that. But anyway, thank you all very much for coming out. It's nice to see you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.